All right, so we're holding on Yud-Ches on the Beis. We're holding, we're holding Shana Hamur of a Bote Orechoyma. But a few lines past the middle of the Amud. Line begins Shaloi. Okay, so we've been they started by saying that in the Mishnah you have Rabbi Eliezer saying that all of the age brackets that it mentions as far as Erchin don't start at the person's birthday, but rather a month after it, because he learns from the first bracket, which begins at a month old. And then we said that the according to the Chum, of course, disagree with that, and Halacha is like the Chachamim, but we started by saying that the years that it says by Kodshin and by Bote Orechoyma, that you have a year to buy back a house in a walled city, and that you have two years in Sdei Ahoza, that if you sold a Sdei Ahoza, you can't buy it back within the first 2 years, and the 6 years of an Eved Ivri, and the years Shebabain v'Shebabas, all of them are Me'esles. All of them are Me'esles. Now, the thing is, Me'esles can actually mean from time to time, meaning in other words, not just the date, but also the time on the clock. And so we mentioned that in connection with Kodshim. We brought a pasuk that says by Kodshim that it has to be Keves ben Shnosoi, meaning Shaloi v'Shaloi Shal Minyan Olam. You don't go according to the calendar years, you go according to the years of the actual animal. And in fact, Tosfos points out, on the face of it, you shouldn't need a pasuk for that because it should be obvious. You obviously can't go according to calendar years. If you did, how could you bring a Korban Tamid on the first day of Rosh Hashanah? The animal was born the day before, then, or a few days before, whatever, because it has to be at least 8 days old to bring as a Korban. By the time Rosh Hashanah comes, it would be already in its second year. So of necessity, it has to be that you go according to the animal's actual years. And one answer that Tosfos says is you're right, but we still wouldn't know from that you go according to the actual hours. Which we've learned in Zvachim, for example, the concept that if an animal was born at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, then a year later, 3 o'clock in the afternoon is when it becomes a year old.
The year
is complete. It has to be to the hour. So we're going to discuss in
the
hour.
Within the hour, it's not necessary.
No, I guess not. With the accuracy of timekeeping that they had in those days, I guess you couldn't really be more accurate than an hour. I guess hypothetically nowadays, maybe. I don't know. So that was as far as Kodshim. Okay. Shana Hamur B'Bote Orechoyma. How do we know the year regarding Bote Orechoyma is Mesles? Dichtiv, as the Pasuk says, Abtoim Shnaf Mimkorei, as the Pasuk says, until the end of the year of Issel. Same thing. Mimkorei Shaloi V'Loi Shana L'Minyan Olam. It means of Issel, you don't go according to calendar years. The same idea. He sold the house for Shodesh Nissen. We don't say that the second year begins Rosh Hashanah. We don't say the year is over at the end of Elul, and therefore come Rosh Hashanah, you can't buy it back anymore. You have till the following year to Shodesh Nissen, which we'll learn about that. We'll learn about that in the last day. Because that's how the Torah says. If you sell a house in Orechoyma, you have a year to buy it back, and if you didn't buy it back within the year, then that's it. It's chalut. It belongs permanently to the other guy, and you're not going to get it back in the Orechoyma. And if it's a field, and if it's a house rather than an unwalled city, then you can buy it back indefinitely, and then if you didn't buy it back, you get it back in the Orechoyma. That's how the Torah says it. We'll talk about the dinim at the end of the, towards the end of the section, in the 8th and 9th paragraph.
It means
a city that had a wall. We'll learn. We'll learn when it has to have a wall. We're going to deal with all those dinim in the last section. Fine. So that has to. So therefore, we see from Shnas Min Koroi that it has to be that goes according to the year, a year from the sale, not a calendar year. And by the way, now Tosfos talked about in the last parak, are we saying that with all of these things, are we saying that they're all also not only from day to day, but also from hour to hour? So if you sold the house at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Rosh Nissen, then you have only till 3 o'clock in the afternoon, then you have till 3 o'clock in the afternoon the following year, Rosh Nissen. So Tosfos says over there, not necessarily. Tosfos says over there, maybe. Maybe indeed it would apply to any of the ones that on which it says Shana over here. So since it's just like that Kodshim, it says Shana, and we do hold of Shoyt over there. The same thing, maybe when it comes to Bote Orechoyma and the various other things we're talking about over here, maybe the same thing would apply and you would actually go according to the hour of the day. Maybe, on the other hand, Tosfos says, not necessarily though. The other possibility is that maybe only by Bokeh Orechoyma and by Korbanos, maybe only there do you say that you go Mesles, not by other things. And actually, the Rambam doesn't even bring it by Bokeh Orechoyma. The Rambam only brings it by Korbanos. So apparently, according to the Rambam, that's the only case where it applies, and it doesn't apply to the other ones. Okay. Shtei Shonim Shabbos Deachuda. well, the I mean, most of these things, most of these halachas we're dealing with are only hilchos of Mashiach. So again, whatever the Rambam paskins for now is the halacha until Mashiach comes. Shebabein v'shebabas, we're going to deal with soon what that means, and that may have relevance. That has relevance now. Also. Okay, fine. How do we know the 2 years by Sdeachoza, that you can't buy it back within the 2 years? How do we know that those are years by, go according to the date when it was sold, not calendar years? Because the pasuk says he sells it to you according to the years of crops. Now, the point is, shnei by itself, the word shnei actually has a double meaning. It means years, but it also means two. But once it says shnei, which could mean two, it can mean two and it can mean years, automatically a year contains crops. So why does it add the word crops? Why does it add the word tavoris? It means pa'amim sha'adam arkel shalosh tavoris b'shteishan. It comes to teach us that you can have a case where a person bought a field and he's able to get three crops out of it within those first 2 years. Namely, Rashi says, suppose that the seller sold it to him in Nissan and there was grain already growing in it. And then he buys it, then he can't buy it back within the first 2 years. So he has to wait until 2 years have passed. So he buys it back in Nissan 2 years later.
He cannot buy back what?
The field. The Torah says, because it doesn't have cost. He can't buy it back within the first 2 years. So if he tells us that, I'm right. So he sold it in Nissan, Tavshin Ayin, and Zion, let's say. Now he buys it back in Nissan, or here, Tavshin Ayin, and Tef. Meanwhile, the other guy has the crops that were growing in Nissan, Ayin, and Zion. That's one crop. Then he plants it the following year in Tishrei, Cheshvan, Ayin, Chet, and harvests it in Nissan of the following year. And then he harvests it now a third time in Nissan of Ayin, Tef. And then he sells it back. So he's gotten three crops in only 2 years.
But he's not compensating the seller for all the work he's put in the field.
Okay, so how that works exactly? How he gets compensated for the work he put into it? We'll deal with those dinim when we deal with the dinim shdeachoza in the last credit. We'll get into those details. Anyway, the point is that if you were to go according to calendar years, that wouldn't work, because if you go according to calendar years, you don't generally have harvests around Tishrei time. Tertius points out you could actually. There are certain crops that you could conceivably have that you could not barley, but whatever. The point is, you could have that you harvested the crop on Chof Tet Elul. But Tertius says, okay, but it's more normal to have three tavoris in 2 years when you count Mesleks rather than when you go according to calendar years. So it's more logical to say the pasuk is teaching us calendar years, not calendar years, but rather years from the actual sale. Okay. Time here, yeah. Okay, next. Sheisha be'evadivri. How do we know the 6 years of an evadivri are me'esles? And again, me'esles may mean actually the time on the clock, or it may just mean from day to day. So if he was sold to Shodesh Nissen, for example, then his term is over to Shodesh Nissen 6 years later. How do we know that? Just if sheish shonim yavod uvashiyis. The pasuk says 6 years he should work, and in the seventh. Now, in context, and in the seventh is the beginning of the next clause. And in the seventh, he goes free. But the fact that the Torah phrases it that way makes it sound like he works for 6 years, and he works in the seventh, meaning Zimnin Mashiach Namiyabar. Sometimes he works into the seventh year, the seventh calendar year. If the Torah didn't mean to say that, it would have said Sheish Shonim Yabar Bashvias, let's say. Or Yetzal HaChofshi Chinam Bashvias, or whatever. The fact that it says Uvashvias implies that sometimes the Shvias, the seventh year, is a continuation of the first 6 years, and he works in it also. So suppose, for example, that he was sold in Nissan of, let's say, Tavshin Ayin Aleph. So then he's working until Nissan Tavshin Ayin Zayin. So you have Ayin Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dalet, Hey, Vav, Zayin. It's already the seventh calendar year, and he's still working. So you see that there, that you see it goes according to dates from when he was actually sold, not calendar years. Okay, Rishabh ben Rabas, Kulan Mesles, and then we said, the Braisa had said that the years regarding a son and a daughter are also Mesles, Lamai Hilsa, as far as what halacha are we talking about? The Omer of Gidol, Omer Rav, La Erchin. So Rav Gidol says in the name of Rav, it means as far as Erchin. What we said, in other words, that, for example, we said there's a bracket of Erchin until 5 years old, and then there's another bracket beginning at 5 years old and going until 20. So it means Mesles. We don't mean, in other words, when the child enters the fifth year, the fifth calendar year of his life. We mean when he's five full years old. Right. And the same thing with 20 and the same thing with the rest of them. Rabbi Yosef on the Lepirkin Diotidokin. Rabbi Yosef says, actually, not aside from Erchin, the Braisa is referring to the dinim that I mentioned in Perek Yotidokin, which is the fifth Perek of Nidah. Most of that Perek deals with various dinim that kick in at various stages of a child's life. You have dinim when a girl is 3, when a boy is 9, when a girl is 11, and then 12, when a boy is 12, and then 13, etc. That so to Rabbi Yosef is saying, this that it says Shabbat Ben and Shabbat is talking about as far as the dinim in that parish. That all of them go based on the kid's actual birthday. And by the way, here you have the Magen Avraham, right? Even if we say, even if we take the view of the possibility that Tosfos says over there in the last parish, that when it comes to most of these dinim, we're talking not only the date, but we're talking the time on the calendar. We're talking the time on the clock. For example, we said Everest Kodshim, everybody agrees with Boter Arichayim or whatever. But in the case of Benu Bas, at least in the case of the dinim, in the case of the dinim in Perek Yotze Dofen, it doesn't say in the Torah Shana by any of them. Therefore, we can't say that we're learning by Zeta Shava or by Mamasino or whatever, that it should apply, that goes according to the time, and therefore it does not. When a boy becomes bar mitzvah, or a girl becomes bar mitzvah, or any of these other things that depend on age, it's strictly when their birthday comes. So, for example, a boy was born, let's say, on the Chodesh Nissan in the afternoon, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, let's say. We don't say he only becomes bar mitzvah at 4 o'clock in the afternoon of Chodesh Nissan 13 years later. No, he becomes bar mitzvah as soon as the night of the Chodesh Nissan starts.
He was born on
Rosh Chodesh Nissan, but he was born, let's say, in the afternoon. He was born, let's say, in the late afternoon. You don't say Rosh Chodesh Nissan. You don't say his bar mitzvah. He only becomes a gadol at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. No, he becomes a gadol when the night of Rosh Chodesh Nissan begins, even though it's almost 24 hours earlier. So Rav Yosef says that as far as that when we say Shabbat Ben Rosh Chodesh, means as far as the halachas in Perek Yotze Dofen. Omle Abaya Rav Yosef mi pogi tusa. Abaya asked Rav Yosef, are you and Rav Yidol necessarily arguing that you're each giving a different explanation of Shabbat Ben Rishabbat? Omle Rav Yosef says, like, ano amri chodah, who am a chodah? No, I'm mentioning one thing that Shabbat Ben Rishabbat can refer to. He's mentioning a different thing, but they're complementary. We both agree that it would apply to both of them. Or not necessarily, but we both agree, but at least Rabbi Yosef is saying, I don't disagree that the same din would apply to Erechim. Does Rabbi Gidol disagree and say that it does not apply to Yosef Dorf, and that we're going to see soon. Okay. So, in fact, the Gemara says, Hachi Nam Stavra, it's logical to say that. De'i Sakudat Akligi, because if you're going to say that Rabbi Gidol and Rabbi Yosef are arguing, well, then you'd have to ask, Manda Amal Erechim, Lo Amal Yosef Dorf. What do you mean, Manda Amal Erechim, Lo Amal Yosef Dorf? Are you telling me that Rabbi Gidol, who says in the name of Rab, that should have been the Shabbat, that we say we go according to 4 years, means only as far as Erechin? Would he say it means not as far as Perek Yotze Dofen? But Rav himself says, who Rav Yidol was quoting over here, Hilchta Bekula Pirka Mesles. The halacha in that entire Perek of Yotze Dofen, whenever we mention an age, it means Mesles. A girl 3 years old, a boy 9 years old, etc. It's always Mesles.
Days in a month, they say.
No, so in other words, Mesles means the months and the days. Means the months and the days, not the calendar years. But therefore, sort of, Gidol is not going to disagree with that and say that halacha is not that it goes according to the actual age, but it goes according to calendar years. So then the question is, well then, Rav Gidol, who says that the Braitha over here, Shabbat Ben Rishabbat, is referring to Erchin, why doesn't he instead explain that's referring to the Dinim and Perek Yotze Dofen? If on the face of it he agrees that they're Mesles based on what Rav is saying, the answer, why doesn't he say, like Rabbi Yosef, why doesn't he explain that that's what the Braitha is talking about when it says Shabbat Ben Rishabbat? The answer is because he would say Dumya Dahanach. He would say the Braitha has to be referring to things that are all similar. Ma Hanach Dechsiva, all the ones that the Braitha mentioned, Kodshim and Bote Orechoyma and Tzdeachoza, etc., it all writes explicitly in the Pasuk. It all mentions in the Pasuk something about the age, something about years. Therefore, Ah Hanach Dechsiva, the same thing, Ben Rabach, has to be something that's explicitly written in the Torah. The Dinim and Perek Yotze Dofen are not explicitly written in the Torah. This, for example, that a girl 3 years old, that bia with her is considered bia, that bia of a 9-year-old boy is considered bia, that ben achatesu in the Torah and Nibdokin, etc. None of those things it says explicitly in the Torah. Therefore, Gidol was going to say, so the Braitha is not, we're not disagreeing that the halacha in those cases is as Mesles, but that's not what the Braitha is referring to, because the Braitha wants to refer to things where it says explicitly in the Torah the word shon or shonim or whatever.
So what does it mean?
So he would say, therefore, it means as far as Erechin. The Braitha is telling us that ages as far as Erechin go according to Mesles, not calendar years. The Idoch, what would Rabbi Yosef answer to that? Rabbi Gidol mentioned that it's as far as Erechin. The question is, why doesn't he say that it's as far as Yotze Dofen? The answer is fine. He agrees it's as far as Yotze Dofen, but he's saying that's not what the Braitha is referring to. The Braitha is only referring to things that it says explicitly in the Pesukim. The Idoch,
it doesn't say
these things about ages in the Pesukim, right? What would Rabbi Yosef answer to that? He says, if you're telling me that the Braisa is only referring to things that it says in the positive, Hai Shabbat Ben Meshabbat Bas, then why does it use the expression Ben Ubas, which is not the term that it uses in the parasha of Erechin, Shabbat Zachar Veshabbat Nekeva, may by the way. It should have used the expression Zachar and Nekeva, which is the expression it uses in the positive in connection with the brackets for Erechin. So therefore, Rabbi Yosef says, granted, you could argue that the Braisa is trying to be consistent and mention only things in the Pesukim, but the very fact that he uses the terminology, Ben Obas, indicates that it's not, that here it's not talking about Erechin. It must be talking about the dinim of Perek Yosef Jason. Okay.
And it talks in Yosef.
Well, in Yosef Jason, it uses the expression Ben Obas.
Ben Obas.
Yeah. Okay, fine. Okay, so before we leave the topic of Erchin per se, the Gemara finishes off with one thing. Also, one of the Mephoshim says maybe the Gemara wanted to end off the Perek with a Dover Toiv. The question is like this: if we look at the ages, if we look at the amounts at the Erchin for the various age brackets, we have like this: for a boy, it starts out at 5 shkolim, so he's from 30 days, so he's 5 years old. Then from 5 shkolim, it goes to 10 shkolim when he's between 5 and 20 years old. Then 50 shkolim when he's between 20 and 60. And then it goes down to 15 after 60. For a girl, the brackets are 3 shkolim, 5, 3 shkolim, 5, 30, and 10. So the question is, proportionately,
5,
and 10. Whereas for a man, it's 5, 10, 50, and then 15. So proportionately, the man is going down north. So the question is, why is it when a woman gets old, when she gets to be 60 or old, when she gets to be older, or 60 or older, then her erech goes down to one-third of what it was before? It goes from 30 to 10. Or maishna zachar, the light koyat tilta. Whereas a male doesn't even keep one-third of his erech. He goes from 50 down to 15, which is less than one-third, because a third would be 16 and two-thirds. So why does he proportionately lose more? Because, like the expression people say, if you have an old man in the house, pacha bebesa, then you have a pacha in the house. What is a pacha? Rashi gives two explanations. One is pacha means something broken, shever, she'ena el lamasa. It's a broken thing, it's just a burden. Or lishnachrin, Rashi says another expression, not pacha, but pachacha, which means maloshin erim the area, something naked, like something useless. So people have an expression that when you have an old man in the house, you have a pacha in the house. Rabbi Negershim gives a different explanation. Also, he says pacha means moikish, means a stumbling block. On the other hand, savta bevesa, so when you have an old woman in the house, sima bevesa, so you have a treasure in the house because then she's still able to accomplish the good things when she's able, as Rashi says, l'tshoya halas malacha b'ziknusa. She can still go, she can still work and still do malacha when she's old. Yeah, that's Rashi's second explanation. Loshanacha pacha, they're sitting right. I'm saying, so there are three explanations. One is that pacha, Rashi's first explanation, it means shever, something broken. Number two is it means something like something naked, like something like a naked person. It's not really worth a lot, you know, because they have no money and no clothes. So the same thing over here. And Rabbi Negershim says it means moitish.
So what is he broken
on? So 1 second. Well, it's on the face of it, we're talking about 60. However, now on the face of it, though, I mean, one second. Okay, Rashi himself lived to be a little over 60, but anyway, okay, so he was 65 when he passed away. Okay, anyway, however, the Chida and some other Achronim point out that one thing we're focusing on over here is when the Sava is the Vesa, when he's in the house. Now, what's he doing in the house? He being an old person, he should be out in the yeshiva teaching Torah. He should be learning and teaching Torah, which he's gained with age. Then he's not a pacha bebeza. When he's in the house, when he's in the house, just being a hassle, doing nothing, they're doing nothing, and then he's a pacha bebeza. But if he goes out to the Beit Medrash and then does something useful with his old age and then he's not. Yeah. There's different other explanations. So 1 second, I'll tell you what the Rebbe said about this. There are also, by the way, there are related ideas that some of the Mephoshim say that a man usually, what the kind of work that a man does is usually hard physical labor, and when he's old, he can't do that anymore. Whereas a woman, what does she usually do? Housework, and when she's old, she can still do lighter housework as well. So therefore, so in that sense, she's more of a treasure in the house as opposed to the man. Now, there is, you mentioned the Rebbe, so there is a sicha from Lamed Ches where the Rebbe shelves it on. So you have this Gemara is quoted in Rashi on the pulpit. Rashi actually adds the words that a woman is not only Sima Bevesa, but Simana Tova Bevesa. It's a good Simon in the house. And the Rebbe explains in detail what's going on over here. Among other things, the question is, if we're saying that the man is like a worthless thing or Murkish or whatever, then why does he have an Erech at all? The very fact that he has an Erech shows that he has some worth.
Right.
And so the gist of it is, the Rebbe explains, first of all, there is a related idea to that, that only when he's a vaser, like when he's not accomplishing anything useful in the world, but also, aside from, excuse me, we are trying to learn Torah over here. Please find some place else for your conversation. Thank you. Okay. So, among other things, the Rebbe, first of all, talks about the idea, with Rashi's first explanation, that tacha means something broken, the Rebbe says not necessarily something broken like what we have in Rashi over here that's useless. A broken thing can still have a use, can still be used for something. We find many halachos in that regard. We have, for example, a broken keli, which sometimes even the broken pieces can still be used for something approximating their original function. So the same thing, an old man, yeah, he can't accomplish everything that he could when he was young, because he doesn't have the strength and everything anymore, but there are all useful things that he can accomplish. Therefore, in that sense, fine, his value goes down a lot, but he still has an erech. Also, the Rebbe talks about the idea, the word pacha, a fourth explanation besides the three very uncomplimentary ones we had over here, the Rebbe points out, a more complimentary one, pacha can also be meloshen by yipach ba'af of nishmas chai, the breath of life that Hashem blew into a person, meaning an old person. And we know, the Rebbe says, all of us have, many of us have zaydis, and we know, as in the song, but zaydi made us laugh, etc., that they're able to transmit something powerful to us of Yiddishkeit and of experience in life and so on and so forth, and a sort of certain love that so therefore, in that sense, the sover, the pacha babesa, in other words, he's breathing a spirit of life, a spirit of life and wisdom and everything into the house. And then the savta, because in particular the Rebbe talks about, she gives daka in the house, therefore she's a treasure and a good simon in the house. Hadron al achet again. So now we're going to digress a little bit. I have no idea. Okay, so now we're digressing kind of from the topic of Erchin per se, and now we're going to talk about a related topic. What about, you can have, besides that, we've talked about a person can pledge their Erech to the Beit Mikdash. We have a person can pledge their Dhamim, which is their actual market value. Now, you can have other kinds of pledges that a person can make having to do with the size or shape or whatever of their body. So we're going to talk about those things. Mishnah says, Ha'omer Mishkoli Olai, if a person says, I pledge to give my weight to the Beit Mikdash, notes in Mishkoli. Okay, well, then he has to give his weight in whatever material. Meaning exactly how much he weighs. He weighs 200 pounds, he has to give 200 pounds. Im kesef kesef, if he said, I'm going to give silver, then he has to give, let's say, 200 pounds of silver. Im zahav, im zahav, zahav. And if he said gold, he has to give 200 pounds of gold. Mind you, by the way, Shittim Kubetis points out from the Rosh, a person doesn't always weigh the same throughout the day. For example, a person wakes up in the morning and they're hungry, they weigh a little more than they do later in the day after they've eaten. So how exactly do you weigh it? So the Rosh says, the family, you go according to the time of day when he made the nether. If he made the nether when he first woke up in the morning, then what we do is when he comes to pay the nether, we weigh him at the same time of the morning and see how much he weighs and go based on that. The Mishnah continues, Maisa be'ima shel Yirmatya, it happened with the mother of Yirmatya, that was the name of a woman, she'omra mishkal b'yola. Yirmatya, Yirmatya, I don't know how it's, yeah, whatever, Yirmatya is how it's usually punctuated in the printed Mishnah. Anyway. So Yirmatya's mother said, she'omra mishkal b'yolai, she said, I pledge to give the weight of my daughter, but also to Yerushalayim, so she went up to Yerushalayim, the shakla mishkal azahav, and she gave her daughter's weight in gold. Now, the Gemara is going to point out, well, how much does the daughter weigh? Yeah, but the point is, the Gemara is going to ask, isn't that story sort of contradictory? You said that it all depends what he pledged. He or she didn't explicitly say gold. Why is she obligated to give X amount of gold? So we'll see in the Gemara. Okay. Mishko Yodi Alai. How about another case? What if a person says, I pledge the weight of my yam? Now, first of all, we have to figure out how far up the yad goes, and that we're going to deal with on the base. Is it to the wrist? Is it to the elbow? Is it to the armpit? You have actually a machloek b'sirashi and tosfos over here about the terminology that the Mishnah uses, but without even getting into that, the question is, how do you... Well, the machloek is basically when the Mishnah says, we hear the word marpit, and on the base it says the word osil, what joint does that refer to? So we'll learn on the base. We'll get into that. The point is, the bigger issue is, though, how do you weigh one individual limb of the body? if you just put it on a scale, either you're going to be slightly lifting it up and then it's underweight, or you're going to be pressing down and then it's going to be overweight. How you weigh the exact weight of that limb, no more, no less. So Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yehuda says, here's what you do. You fill up a barrel of water. He puts in his arm until his marfik. Now here's where Rashi explains that marfik means his armpit. So according to Rashi, he would have to put in the entire length of his arm. That would be included in the word yad. And in other words, according to Rashi, the word yadi means the entire length of his arm. According to Tosfos, no, marfik means his elbow. So according to Tosfos, yadi means only his forearm and his hand. Anyway, he sticks that in to the water as far as necessary. And then we see how much we see. So what you do is, in other words, you fill up the barrel till the brim. When he puts his hand in, some of the water spills out. Now we need to refill it. So what do we do? Then he takes flesh of a donkey together with bones and gidim, all of a donkey, the nose and the circle, and start putting that into the barrel until it's full to the brim again. And then the volume of what you put in is equal to the weight, the reason why we use donkey flesh specifically is because that's most similar among animals to the consistency and the weight of a human's body. So therefore, that's what Rabbi Yehuda says is you do. So you do like that, and then you take the pieces. You take the pieces, and you know how much they weigh. And therefore, what does he mean by the way? Our committees came up with the concept of specific gravity, specifically as far as measuring a crown. Fine, but that doesn't mean, in other words, that they didn't know the basic concept before. He applied it to measuring gold and silver. Okay, it could be. Anyway, so the point is, in other words, that now when we say the shoiko, on the face of it, shoiko means he weighs. But Rashi says it doesn't necessarily have to mean, according to Rashi, it doesn't necessarily have to mean that he weighs them per se. Shoiko could just mean he takes them. But shoiko could also mean he weighs them, and we're mentioning that out of order because eventually the purpose of this is to weigh them. Tosfos on Amud Beis says a different possibility, which is that you have to weigh these donkey flesh and bones and whatever before you put them in the water. Otherwise, they absorb water, and therefore, when you take them out, they're going to be heavier, and then you're going to unfairly be making the guy pay more. So you have to weigh their dry weight first, and then you're going to put them in the water, and then. Okay. Hello. Okay. So that's Rabbi Yehuda. Amr Rabbi Yossi says, how are you going to get the exact proportions of flesh and bones? Fine, you're telling me that donkey flesh is about the same consistency and the same specific gravity as human flesh, and bones as bones, but still, inevitably, you're going to have, let's say the arm is, 41% bone and then 37% muscle or whatever. You're not going to get the exact same proportions when you're using donkey pieces. Rabbi Yossi says you don't need to do that. You just go. You figure out how much the arm weighs, and you make them pay that amount.
What, you put it on
a
scale?
And let's say, for example, he says put it on a scale, and that's good enough. Yeah. Okay. So the most sort of my in kesef kesef im zahav zahav. What do we mean? We said a person pledges his weight to the Beis Mikdash. We said if he says silver, then he gives silver. And if he said gold, he gives gold. Amar Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says that's what it means. Pirush kesef, kesef. If he specified, I'm going to give my weight in silver, then he has to give his weight in silver. Pirush zahav zahav. And if he said specifically, one second, that's what we have to figure out. If he said specifically gold, then he has to give gold. So the question is, pshita, isn't that obvious? The answer is Hok Mashmalon. Yes, but the Chiddush that Rabbi Yehuda wants to tell us is, and that the Mishnah is implying, is time of the Pirush. Why are you making him give silver or gold respectively? Only because he specified silver or gold. Ha loy Pirush, but had he not specified anything, Pater Nafshe Becholdehu, then he could pater himself with anything that is normally weighed in that area. Anything in that area that is normally sold by weight would be good enough. Namely, Kerachla. One second, Kerachla. For example, like what Rachla says, the Omer Rachla, but Asra de Tachli Kufra, in places where they weigh tar, in other words, you have places where they sell tar by volume, but then you have places where they sell it by weight. If you live in a place where the normal thing is to sell tar by weight, Pater Nafshe after the Bekufra, then if a person says, I pledge my weight to the Beis Mikdash, then he can pater himself by giving his weight in tar. He doesn't have to give silver or gold or whatever. De Tachli means they weigh, Kufra means tar. But after the coal-fired tar, pitch to be more exact. I mean, tar, strictly speaking, is what they get out of petroleum. That's what they use nowadays for paving roads. Coal-fired pitch, actually, which comes from pine trees and other related trees, whatever. Same idea. Same idea. The point is, if it's something that's normally weighed in this area, therefore it's something that's normally sold by weight. Therefore, you can say that yeah.
Goodbye.
Very clever. No, but that's not what I mean. So again, the question is, pshita, okay, but if Rachva's point is that whatever is normally weighed in this area, you can pay with that, then why did he have to mention tar?
Right.
He could have mentioned anything.
Right.
The answer is, loitzricha, yes, but the chiddush that Rachva wants to tell us by mentioning tar, the ikka de tokal, the ikka de kayo. Suppose you have, in this area, you have some people sell it by weight and other people sell it by volume. The tokel means weighing it. No, tokel is like shekel in Hebrew, so it means the weight. The ikka de kayo, and then there are those who measure it out, meaning by volume. So, mao de tema, so then you would think to say, kibin de kulu loitakli, since not everybody in this place sells it by weight, loy, then you would say maybe not. Maybe therefore we can't consider, when he said I make a nether to pay my weight, maybe he can't use tar because not everybody sells tar by weight. Kamash Malon, that is Rachva's point. As long as you have a significant number of people in this area, he doesn't even say whether it has to be the majority, but as long as you have a significant number of people who for whom tar is considered to be something that's sold by weight, then he can pay his amount in tar to this Mekdash and he's good. What is the Bet HaMikdash going to do with that amount of tar? As usual, I mean, if they need it for repairs around the Bet HaMikdash, good. And if not, then they'll sell it to the highest bidder and use it to buy something else that they need. Amar Papa, so the Papa says in this connection, but Astra de Tafli Shanki, in places where they sell onions by weight, Potanakshi Afila Bashanki, then he can pasture himself even by paying his weight in onions. So again, the question is, Peter, isn't that obvious? It's the same point as before. Yeah. No, he didn't obviously, if he specifically said onions, obviously, we're talking about if he just said, I pledge to pay my weight. But let's say we're in a place where they sell onions by weight. Like nowadays, you sell, you buy 2 and 3 pound bags of onions. So therefore, so the Papa is saying that you could do that. So the question is, Pshita, the answer is, Lloyd Tzricha, yes, but the Papa's Chiddush is, the boss of the Shakli, suppose that you're in a place where after they weigh out, so you're buying, let's say, 5 pounds of onions, so they weigh out for you 5 pounds of onions, and then after that, Shadu Tre Tilta, after that, the seller throws in an extra 2 or 3 for free, Mao de Tema bottle turtles mishkol. You would argue by doing that, the seller is in effect saying, we're not selling it by weight, and therefore it shouldn't be considered something that's normally weighed out. Kamash Malan, therefore that's the chiddush. We don't say that the throwing in 2 or 3 extra is considered to be mivatel.
What would it be if you throw 2 or 3 extra?
If you would think, it means that now we're not selling it by weight. We're essentially selling it by number or by volume or what have you, and therefore it doesn't count as something by weight. Kamash Malan. Tosfos points out, actually, we learned in Baba Basra that whenever you're weighing something for somebody back in those days where they use balance scales, you always have to give the customer a little extra anyway to make sure that you're not under, to make sure you're not giving them under, not so much enough per se, but more that you're not allowed to do false weights and measures. In other words, the point is, for example, you're doing a balance scale, you have, let's say, that, it's not really so much false weights and measures, we learn it from a prophet, Tzadik Mishokha, the 10 law, whatever, the point is, it's hard to tell you, you have to give a little extra. You have to give a look.
You have several sets of weights.
Right, but the idea is, but the idea is, you have to have your weights themselves have to be completely accurate and honest. But even within that, when you're putting, let's say, a pound weight on this side of the scale, and let's say a pound of grain or meat or what have you on this side, you're obligated, off Yalacha, to give a little more than a pound. So that the scale balances a little down this way. After we learned in Baba Basra, there's 2 different ways of doing it. You can have a fixed percentage that you give him, or you can have that you make the that you make one side go a tefach down more than the other. Whatever. The point is, you're obligated off Yalacha to give him a little extra. Tosfos says what we mean is, though, that the vendor gave him extra beyond that. So let's say, in other words, so you have, in a beyond that. So let's say, in other words, so you're buying 5 pounds of onions. So the guy weighs out, and he's obligated off the halacha to give you, let's say, 5.1 pounds. And then after that, on top of that, he throws in another 2 or 3. So you would argue then he's not doing it by weight anymore. Kamash Malon or Papa is telling us, no, it's still basically by weight. Yeah. Okay.
He's just adding
a little extra. Then we said in the Mishnah, Mais be'ima show your matzio chola. We said it happened with your matzio's mother that she pledged to give her daughter's weight, and she gave her daughter's weight in gold. So the Mishnah says, Mais of the stir. Are you telling me a case to challenge, to contradict what we said in the Mishnah? Before we said in the Mishnah that If you didn't say anything, then you can get away with it. We just said in the Gemara that you can pay your weight in tar or in onions or whatever. Why are we here? We doubt to say she had to pay in gold. The answer is chasurim that. So the Mishnah is actually missing a phrase. V'hachi katani, what the Mishnah means to say is like this. The im adam choshevu, if this person who made the nether is an important, meaning rich person, then even if he didn't specify how much he intends to give, then we say lafik vodei amrinan or amdinan. Really, then we have to evaluate based on their cover, based on what would be appropriate for their station. And indeed it happened that Yomasiya's mother, who was apparently very rich, Shamra Mishka Biti Alai, but also Yoshalayim Shakluv enough for Mishkal Azar, because she was rich, and therefore she was rich enough to be able to afford it in gold, and therefore even if she didn't specify, we assume that it would be like beneath her dignity to give anything less than gold. But I don't know, history doesn't record that detail. Maybe she was a widow, maybe, who knows, I don't know. So usually we say, now with that said, Mephoshim say, now that you mention it, if afterwards she specifically says, when I made the nether, I did not have in mind gold, I had in mind some lesser material, then fine, we can take her at her word and we're doing that. We're saying that if she doesn't say that, then we take it. Okay. Ha'omer k'mosi olai, suppose a person says, I pledge my height, well then, so he has to give something equal to his height. It means he pledges something equal to his height to the Bris Mikdash. Therefore, noisin sharbit she'ena nichba. He's obligated to give a stick that cannot be bent to the Bris Mikdash. Meaning, again, the material will depend on what he mentioned, whether he mentioned gold or silver, or whether he's rich enough, or whatever. But if he doesn't mention anything, again, it could be that Rambam says it could be even wood. But it has to be at least his height, and it has to be thick enough that it can't be bent. Or at least that it can't be bent with it can't be bent by hand. Let's say obviously you can find machines to bend anything, but. So let's say, for example, the Ima Shel Yomasiya, suppose she had said that I pledge my daughter's height to the Bris Mikdash, she would have been obligated to measure her daughter's height and then bring to the Mikdash. She would find her daughter is, let's say, 5 feet tall. So then she would bring a golden stick, 5 feet tall, and thick enough that it cannot be bent, and that would be the payment of her pledge to the Bris Mikdash.
But gold can't be bent.
If it's thick enough, it can't. Maloy Kaimasi, on the other hand, if the person, now again, if he specifies, he specifies. If he didn't specify, then he can give even wood. Mephoshim say, though, now here he can't get away with tar or onions, like we said before. It has to be something that you can make one solid stick out of. So therefore, it can be wood, it can be gold, it can be silver, but it can't be tar and it can't be onions or other things like that. Could it be chocolate? I don't know. That's a good question. Okay. I don't know. Why not?
Because you can bend chocolate.
Well, if you make it thick enough, I guess you can't. I don't know.
I wouldn't mind.
Okay. Okay. On the other hand, if he says, Maloy koi mosi alai, but if he says the fullness of my height is an obligation on me, then all he means is his height. Therefore, noisin shavit hanichba. Therefore, he still has to give a stick that's his height, but it doesn't have to be so thick that it can't be bent. It can even be thin enough to be bent.
If he says,
Maloy koi mosi. Maloy kamasi means the fullness of my height. So then it just means only his height, no thickness at all. So therefore, it's not obligated to have any particular thickness. Okay, the Gemara says, mate, we have a contradiction. A Braisa says,
well, it's not thick enough. If it could bend, then it's not going to be height.
When stretched out, it's his full height. So you could have, let's say, for example, so he takes, let's say, for example, a thin strip of gold, let's say, or silver or what have you, which is it. Thin enough, it'll bend easily, but when you stretch it out, it's full height. So what does it mean? You have a contradiction. A braisa says, kaimasi alai or maloi kaimasi alai, whether he says kaimasi or maloi kaimasi, either way, noisin shavit chain and nichbab, either way, he has to give a stick that's thick enough to not bend. So what are you telling me that there's a difference whether he says kaimasi or maloi kaimasi? The answer is Huda Omar Rabbi Akiva. You're right, but Rabbi Huda is saying his din specifically according to Rabbi Akiva, the Dayak Lishna Yaseira, where Rabbi Akiva finds meaning in extra wording that a person uses and derives halachas from it of what the person meant. Meaning like this. Let's learn the case and then we'll understand. It's not. We learn in a Mishnah in Baba Basra. If a person sells a house to somebody else, loyus ad bur veloyus ad dus. He has not automatically sold the bur or the dus that's in it. A bur is an underground cistern where they have water or whatever. A dus is an above ground one with walls. Anyway, you haven't automatically sold those. Even if he writes in the contract that I'm selling you the house together with the depths and together with the height, even then those things are not included unless he specifies them, because those are considered some, those are considered something of their own. They're considered an independent entity. In other words, by writing umka varuma, what he's accomplished is, if he hadn't written that, it would mean, for example, that the buyer would not be able to dig under the house. It would mean that the seller, for example, would be able to, would still have air rights over the house, for example. Umka varuma means the depths and the heights. In other words, if a person sells a house to somebody else, if he doesn't say umka varuma, not only is the bird and dus not included, but even the ground under the house is not included. So the buyer has the seller retains the rights to the ground underneath it, to dig out over there. In general, we say you go. Well, one second. With dinim mamonis, in many things, including in these things, you go according to the minig on the dinner. If minig on the dinner is that when you sell a house, you're selling automatically the land. Okay, so then in that case, then it's automatically included. But we're talking about if in those times and in those places where it wasn't specified, if you don't say umka varuma, you haven't sold the underground rights, and you haven't sold the rights to the airspace above the house. But if you write umka varuma, then you've sold those as well. But the bird and the dus are still considered an independent entity, and therefore they're not considered sold unless they were specific. Or the dus. The bird is an underground cistern, an underground pit that's in there, that's in the house, and a dus is an above ground one, where you have walls built like an above ground swimming pool, kind of would be an example of a dus. Yeah. The tzarech likach lo derech, divrei Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva says, if the seller, now you have the seller sold a house to somebody else, and we're saying the bur or the dus still belong to the seller, he has to buy himself a path to get to that bur or dus, divrei Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Chum says he doesn't need to, because Rabbi Akiva holds the famous idea, Moshe ba'ayin yofa Moshe, when you're selling as generously as possible. Therefore, we assume that you sold the entire footprint of the house, so minus the bur and the dus. But therefore, in other words, if you want to have an easement to be able to get to the bur and the dus, you have to buy it from the guy. But the Chacham say no. So you'd have to tell him, I want to buy an easement from you. Chacham say it's not necessary. Once the bur and the dus are not included, automatically Moshe ba'ayin ra Moshe, we assume that you sold as stingily as possible, and that you meant to still retain for yourself not only the bur and the dus, but also access, also an easement to get to them. So therefore, the Chacham say,
not
there.
So when you don't specify the bur inside?
If you specify the bur, there's nothing to talk about. Obviously, you sold the bur. If you sold the house, you didn't mention anything about the bur and the dus, that's where you have the machlokes. One second. Umoder Rabbi Akiva. Now, Rabbi Akiva would agree, this man sha'omal et chut me'elu, if the person explicitly says, I'm selling you the house, but not the bur or not the dus, then Rabbi Akiva agrees he does not have to buy an easement to get to it, because Rabbi Akiva says he didn't have to mention the bur and the dus at all, because by default they're not included. The fact that he mentioned them is to imply that he wants to not only retain them, but also access to them. The fact that he did mention them, he didn't have to mention them. If he hadn't mentioned the bur, he would still own the bur anyway. Rabbi Akiva is learning from the higher thing. Either way, he's entitled to access. Rabbi Akiva is saying there's a difference whether he mentioned the bur or dus explicitly or not. He didn't have to mention it, because automatically when you sell a house, the bur is not included. So if he didn't say anything at all, we assume that he's keeping the bur, but he still needs to buy access rights. So he still needs to buy a path to be able to get to the burr. But if he explicitly said, I'm selling you the house, but I'm not selling you the burr, then it means that he intends to keep access to the burr as well, and he doesn't have to buy that separately. So the point is, Rabbi Akiva is learning from the extra wording that he used. Yeah, according to Rabbi Akiva, he would have to pay for it. So the point is, No, he's paying for the access. The water itself, it still belongs to him because the water, the borough itself still belongs to him according to everybody. The point is, in other words,
it seems obvious if you can specify this, it's huge.
The borough is his, but does that mean that the path to the borough is his? Rabbi Akiva is saying, because he specified the borough, and he didn't have to, because either way, the borough belongs to him, specifying the borough means specifying the access, exactly.
Oh,
Rabbi Akiva is learning that from the extra wording that the guy uses, whereas the Chachamim do not make that distinction. Therefore, applying that sort of Yehuda's din, if the person says kaimasi alai, versus when he says maloi kaimasi alai, the fact that he used the extra word maloi, says Rabbi Yehuda, according to Rabbi Akiva, that would imply that he's saying that I'm not obligating myself in so much. I'm obligating myself in less. Something that's my height, but not necessarily that it has to have any specific width. As opposed to kaimasi, would imply it has to have a specific width as well. So enough for it not to be able to bend right. Kosis points out, if we understand it that way, then the braisa that was quoted against Rabbi Yehuda doesn't seem to go according to either the Chachamim or Rabbi Akiva, because even the Chachamim would agree that if he specified, they would say that he still owns the access rights either way. So, okay. So we don't know who that braisa was. Okay. Fine. So we see from that, Kibin Beloit Sodis, since the seller of the house didn't need to mention the Jews, Vika Omar, and he said that I'm keeping the Jews, L'tafuya milsakofi, it means he's keeping himself something extra, not only the Jews, but also the access rights there. Hachanami, the same thing over here, Kibin Beloit Sodis, since he doesn't need to say the word Meloi, Vika Omar, and he says the word Meloi, L'tafuya milsakofi, it means he's adding something that he's saying, I'm not pledging something that's going to stand by itself. I'm pledging something that won't be able to stand by itself, but which is my own. Okay. Now we have a question like this. What if a person says a neder, what if he says, my oimdi? Literally, my oimdi means my stature. So Rashi explains that the question is does that mean that he's pledging something, the height of when he stands, or maybe not? Maybe it doesn't mean anything. So would he be obligated to pay something that's at least his height or not? Yeah. One second. Roish by mahu. What if he said, I pledge my width? Does that mean that it has to be, it needs to be as tall as he is and also as wide as he is? Or does it mean only that it's the length of his width? In other words, you know, a person's width is, let's say, you know, 2 feet. So, one second, when he says roich by mahu, what does it mean? Does it mean that he's pledging, for example, a stick which is 6 feet tall and 2 feet wide, let's say, which is roich by my width? Or does he mean I'm only pledging a stick, roich, I'm pledging a stick 2 feet long? Or yeshivas by mahu, what if he pledges my sitting? Again, does it mean, for example, something that's as wide as he is when he's sitting, or does it mean only the length of the area? Does it mean the length and width of where he sits? Oivye mahu, what if he says my thickness? Same idea. Hekeifu mahu, what if he says my circumference? Keifu, and then teiku by all these. Now, according to Rashi, each of these is an independent question. The question is, what does he mean with each one of these? Tosfos on Amud Aleph explains, according to one explanation, that it's actually a series of questions where one depends on the other. It's an imtim taloyma series. Tosfos says like this. You could argue like this. When he says oimdi, then maybe it means that he has to give a stick that's thick enough to not bend, or maybe it can be thin enough that it, as long as it stands independently, even though it could easily be bent, but because it's oimdi, it just has to be able to stand, so maybe that's enough. If you're going to say that oimdi means that it's something that can be bent, then what about roichboi, where, after all, a person's width cannot be bent. A person can bend themselves, a person can bend at the waist, a person can bend double like this, but a person can't bend like that, kind of. A person can't bend their width, their thickness from side to side. So maybe, therefore, it would mean something that can't be bent. Or again, maybe it means something that's only 2 feet wide, which is about how wide he is, and therefore it could even be bent. If you're going to say that roichva means one that could be bent, then what about yeshivasi? Yeshivasi could mean that if a stick as long as my body, even when I'm sitting, which is essentially the same as his height, or does it mean that it can mean something that could? Okay, but no, okay, so maybe it means Kemoshani Yoshev Meroshi Van Ragloi, right, Tosfos says, that as I'm sitting from head to toe, so you're right, maybe it means then the shorter amount, let's say from here until the floor, let's say, yeah. Or does it mean that could be one that's bent, which after all, when you're sitting, your body is bent. if you're going to say that it means that one that could be bent, then what about if he says ovio, my thickness, where a person's thickness can't be bent? And if you're going to say ovio implies something that could be bent, what about hekefo, my circumference? Does it mean that it has to be something so thick that it has to be like a thick hoop that could go around his body and that can't easily, that's thick enough that it can't easily be straightened out? Or does it mean something that could go around his body and it's thin enough to be bent? So those are the different possibilities. It just brings a couple of other possibilities. Yeshivoso, for example, could mean that. Does it mean, for example, only from his head until where he's sitting, or does it mean the whole? Does it mean his whole height? Yeshivoso means his circumference. Yeah. So again, according to Frosa's explanation, does it mean? In other words, does he have to give a piece which is thick, it's wide enough, its circumference is the circumference of his body, so his waist size, but in addition, thick enough that it will retain that shape, that it can't easily be unbent? Or does it mean it can even be thinner? It could be bent out of shape, as long as when he gives it, it can be wrapped around his waist. And then again, yeshivosi, Tosfos says a couple of other possibilities. It can mean yeshivosi could mean only from head to waist, or it could mean from head to toe. Yeshivosi could mean maybe, the area of his feet. Anyway, teiku. So what does it mean, teiku? So the Rambam says, what it means is in each of these cases, we make him pay until the point where he says, this is more than what I intended. In other words, we can ask him, if he explains and says what he meant, then obviously you only have to pledge that amount. But if not, if he himself is not clear what he meant. So let's say, for example, in the case of yeshivosei mahu, so in the case of roichloi mahu, for example, where according to Rashi, the question is, are we saying that he has to give something his height and width, or only something his width? So we would make him pay, so let's say, for example, we would say paying the width, paying a stick 2 feet long is not enough. You have to pay a stick 6 by 2. If he says, loy l'kachlis kavanti, that's not what I meant, then we figure out what he might have had in mind.
Okay, you can't do that right now.
I said yeshivosi olai, and I'm not sure what I meant. Yeah. Right. Yeah. But if he can't remember, then they tell him until he says, I obviously can't possibly have meant this much. Okay. Also, the Rambam says if he dies and you're getting it from his yoshim, then you go according to the least of them, because you can't take away from the yoshim without a solid proof. Okay. We said in the mission of Mishko Yodi Olai, that if the person says, I pledge the weight of my hand, so we said, we had Rabbi Yehuda had said that you have to figure out the volume of his hand as accurately as possible using junky flesh, and Rabbi Yehuda said he didn't. So turn on our bottom, we learn in a braisa, more details. Mishko Yodi or Mishko Ragli Olai, if a person says, I pledge the weight of my yad or the weight of my regel, and we're going to see soon that the word yad and the word regel can have multiple meanings. The word yad can mean only the palm of the hand, only the hand. It can mean only the hand up to the wrist. It can mean up to the elbow, and it can mean up to the shoulder.
It can mean up to the elbow.
Yeah. Yeah, what do you think? Yeah. So Rabbi Hoda, maybe chobit, you bring a barrel, a mala mine, you fill it to the top with water, or machnes the yad on the otil of a regular adar kubah. If he had pledged the weight of his yad, then he has to stick it in until the osil, where again you have the machlokes Rashi and Tosfos, whether the osil means the elbow or the armpit. Anyway, with a regular ad akuba, with the foot he would have to stick it in until the akuba, which would be the knee. The shokel b'sar chamor akuba is the knee. The shokel b'sar chamor gidim asamas, you weigh out flesh and veins and sinews and bones and whatever of a donkey, the nose on the surface, and you start putting them into the belt of a dead donkey, obviously. Yeah. What do you mean?
Rigid.
It doesn't really weigh more because it's rigid. It's stiffer. It doesn't really weigh more. No. Anyway, so you take those, the nose and the flesh, so you put them into the barrel. Again, you use donkey because it's most similar in composition to human flesh. So you put it in there, add to the smala until it's full to the top, and then the weight of those pieces equals the weight of the arm. Now, why do you use dafka donkey? Even though, Rabbi Yehuda says, even though there's not a solid proof that you should dafka use donkey pieces, zeichel adava, we have a zeichel chain and a pasuk, shenema, because we have a pasuk in Yechezkel, Asher that their flesh, talking about the Mitzrayim, is like the flesh of donkeys. in context, it's talking about how the Jewish people are, we learn from that, Amadon Melachamer, but in context, it's talking about how the Jewish people are attracted, or, no, in context, it's talking about how the Jewish people are attracted to Mitzrayim, and they're making alliances with them and whatever, even though they're like donkeys, they're useless, and then not at all on your level, but nevertheless, we see that there's a comparison between human beings and donkeys. Okay, I mean, Rabbi Yaakov Emden points out the actual comparison in Tosfos over there is Besar Chamorim. Besar is actually a euphemism for the male genitals. In context, in the Pesukim over there, the Navi is comparing the Jewish people to Razona, who's going with any man that she can find, and therefore that she's going with Mitzrayim because they have these overdeveloped, So and that doesn't even have bones in it. So it's obviously not a real raya that you should use that to compare it to the arm, which has bones in it, but still it's a zecher to the idea. Amalei Rav Yosi. So Rav Yosi says that doesn't work. Heichat shalachavin baser kineged baser, gidim kineged gidim, asamas kineged asamas. How are you going to get the exact proportions of flesh and sinews and bones of the junkie as you do in a human being's arm? Amalei Rav Yehuda Oimdin. So Rav Yehuda says you're right. At a certain point, you have to estimate it. Amalei Rav Yosi. So Rav Yosi says ad sha Oimdin. Okay, then instead of estimating, you're moidu with a yad. Let's just measure the hand directly, and let's just measure instead of having to measure using both of the gidim ba'atzomos, where ultimately you're going to have some kind of approximation, just approximate using the hand itself without needing the b'sar chamor. So the Gemara answers Rav Yehuda. What would Rav Yehuda answer to that? Kake, you're not going to get it 100% accurate. The answer is he would say kama de efshar abdinus. He would say, okay, but you have to try to get it at least as accurate as you could. It's not going to be 100% accurate, but better to at least get some degree of accuracy. I don't know. The point is, you should try to get it as accurate as possible. The fact is, nowadays, they have more sensitive equipment. You probably have other, nowadays, maybe you take an MRI of a guy's arm and then be able to figure out exactly based on that. I don't know. But whatever, the point is that Rabbi Yehuda is saying, granted, we're not going to get 100% accuracy, but Rabbi Yossi, you're saying, therefore, we shouldn't even try for any accuracy? No, we should try at least to get as accurate as possible.
Why can't you just put his arm on the table?
Because when you put your arm on a table, one of two things happens. Either you hold it up a tiny bit, or you press it down a tiny bit. It's very hard to get it that you're going to be doing exactly without getting it, or without putting any extra pressure or not. It's very hard to.
Put it on the table, attach it to a string, and the string to a weight, and then as soon as the weight is greater than the arm, then the arm starts going up, and you can measure it. It's not that difficult.
No, but the point is, because you can still press down your arm. You could still be putting more pressure on it.
You're asking to,
but it's hard to relax 100%. Okay. So the question is the yad ad ha'asil. So you're telling me that when he pledges the weight of his arm, so fine, both. Okay, so you're telling me that both Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi agree with the basic idea that the yad goes until the osu, the armpit according to Rashi, or the elbow according to Tosfos. The question is that really so? Or Aminu, I have a contradiction. We learned in Cholin, Kiddush Yadayim V'Raglayim B'Mikdash Ad HaPerek, that when they did Kiddush Yadayim V'Raglayim in the Mikdash, they only had to wash their hands until the wrist. So the yad, and because the pasuk says we're off to yadayim v'raglayim, so we see that the word yad is only until the wrist. You're telling me in the bright that the word yad is until the elbow or until the shoulder. So why is that? The answer is the araisa adaparek. The definition of yad in the Torah is until the wrist. But in the Dorim, when it comes to the Dorim, the general rule with the Dorim is you have to follow common terminology. And the common terminology when people use the word yad is it means some part of the arm as well. The whole arm the whole arm according to Rashi or the forearm according to Tosu. Okay. The question is. The question is, Udaraisa ad aperet. You're telling me that Midaraisa, the meaning of yad, means only until the wrist? Well, Gabi Tfilin. What about when it comes to Tfilin? Dichtiv Yodcha. The process is you have to put Tfilin on your hand. The Tonad Veminasha, and Tonad Veminasha says, no, Yerach Zuki Boris. That Yodcha, rather, Zuki Boris. The word Yodcha means the biceps. You wrap the strap of the Tfilin around your finger, fine, but that's a minute. That's not. What do you mean, how do you know? We learned from an office. Where do you put on your stolen treasure? Where are you putting your stolen treasure? Do you put it over here or you put it over here? You put it over here.
The tefillin you put, which you tie it to
Yom. Never mind that. The point is, the actual tefillin itself, shartam lo'os al yodecha, and yodecha doesn't mean you put it on your hand. That was what the tzedukim or whoever did. You put it on your biceps. Or Karoim or whoever it was did that, yes. You put it on your biceps. So we see that the word yad includes all the way up to the amidaraisa. So the answer is, you're right. Daraisa kiboris kola.
Why do we say the bracha on nothing instead of Sure.
So there's a famous explanation, I think, from the Rabbi Trevor that says, the question is why we say l'hamniach tefillin rather than l'kshor tefillin. So there's an explanation from the Rabbi Trevor that there's a difference between the shoyad and the shorosh. The shoyad, you put on the tefillin, and then that way, at that point, you've accomplished the mitzvah. Whereas the shorosh, the mitzvah is the whole time it's on your head. Okay, so then you say, okay, so why the lashon is l'hamniach? I'm not looking into that. Okay, anyway, the point is that we're not negay over here. So rather, let's say like this. Da'araisa kiboris kula. You're right. Da'araisa, the word yodcha means the entire arm, all the way up to the biceps, so all the way up to the shoulders, essentially. So that would still be considered yad. When we say, ukshautam lo'os al yodecha, that's what it means. So yes. On the other hand, benedorim, holochacholoshim ne'adam. On the other hand, when it comes to benedorim, you have to go according to common terminology. And therefore, and one more, the kiddush adayim v'raglayim v'mikdash shuchzik mirila. On the other hand, when it comes to kiddush adayim v'raglayim v'mikdash, there we have a halacha l'moshe mitzinai, that it means only until the brit. So in other words, there are three definitions of yad. For most purposes, daraisa, yad includes the upper arm, such as for tefillin. For Kiddush Adayim Raglayim, which is also Daraisa, a halacha Moshe Mitzinai tells us only until the wrist. And so the wrist. So Kiddush Adayim Raglayim. And for Nedarim, you go according to Loshen B'nai Adam, and since Loshen B'nai Adam is some part of the arm is included in Yodcha, then that's what it means. According to Rashi, the definition of Loshen B'nai Adam would be essentially the same as what's in the Torah, because both of them means including the upper arm. According to Tosfos, no, Loshen B'nai Adam would be until the elbow, and Loshen Torah means until the shoulder. Okay, so that takes care of Yad. Now, what about Beregel Adhar Kuba? What are we saying that on the if a person pledges the weight of his foot, so you have to weigh it until the Akuba, until the knee? The Gemara says a Raminu. I have a contradiction. We learn in Chagiga that we talk about the different categories of people who are potter from Aliyah Regel, and the potter says Regolim, Sholosh Regolim, Tachos Yerashana. Regolim means times when you go up on foot. Means Prat Labali Kabin, means as opposed to people who have an artificial foot. Right. Yeah, as opposed to somebody who has an artificial foot, meaning the person can have their foot amputated and they have a prosthetic foot. So the point, that's far below the knee. If you're saying that regal includes all the way up to the knee, why shouldn't they be chayiv and on the other regal? Again, you go according to Loshon Ne'adim. Yes, maybe in the Torah, regal means even only the lower, means until the ankle. So the ankle. But in Loshon Ne'adim, it includes higher until the knee. So the question is, in Loshon Ne'adim, that they used in those days, yeah. So the question is, daraisa prat bale kabin. So you're telling me that on a daraisa level, therefore, somebody who has an artificial foot is potter from aliyah l'rego because they're missing a foot. What about when it comes to chalitza? Yichtiv ragloi. It says that she has to take off the shoe from his foot. V'tana, and we learn in a braita, it's actually a mishnah, so it's nan. Cholta min ha'akubo l'mata. If she does chalitza from the knee downward, chalitza is kosher, and the chalitza is kosher. So in other words, let's say, for example, Rashi says, so let's say the Yavam's foot was amputated, as long as there's some part of the leg left below the knee, then the shoe can be placed on that, and it's a valid chalitza. Tosfos actually learns a little... Right, it would be on the stump. It would be on the stump, in other words. Tosfos actually explains it a little bit differently. Tosfos says that what we're talking about is that what we mean is, Not that the foot was amputated per se, but we're talking about where the straps of the shoe are tied. Are they tied below? Are they tied on the leg below the knee, or are they tied above the knee? As long as it's high below the knee, then it's kosher. So the point is, in other words, so we see that even on a daraisa level, the word regal includes all the way up to the knee. The answer is shiny hosom. It's different over there. Because the person doesn't just say that she has to take the shoe from his foot. Me'al ragla means from what's above his regal. So the regal itself in Torah terminology means until the heel or until the ankle. And then the next part of the leg, the shins above that until the knee, is considered al ragla, is above his regal. So the question is, then why shouldn't the same thing be true if his foot was amputated above the knee, or according to Tosfos, if the straps of the shoe are tied above the knee, why shouldn't it be kosher? So it's also me'al ragla. The answer is me'al, v'lo me'al de me'al. Yeah, but it has to be what's directly above the foot, not what's above the foot. Above the knee already would be me'al de me'al. Therefore, it would be possible.
So it has to be
under the knee. You have the regal itself means until the heel or until the ankle, or whatever. Then you have the part from there up to the knee is me'al ragloi, and that's still kosher. From the ankle to the knee would be me'al ragloi, so that's still kosher. Above that would be me'al to me'al, and that's no good. Omer a papa, so the papa says, by the way, in this connection, shmamina, we can see from this a point of anatomy. Chai istivira, the istivira, which Rashi translates with a French word that means the ankle, ad aranosis. It goes all the way down to the ground. In other words, the same bone, that or the same complex or whatever bone that forms the ankle also goes all the way and forms the heel. You don't say that there's no other joint over there. There's no other. Now in the human foot, you have there's actually a couple of bones that are fused together over there. They're called the tarsus, and that they include the area of the ankle and include the heel and include part of the arch and whatever. So the papa is telling us, you can see from this halacha that's how it is. That biologically that's how it is. You don't have one bone that forms part of the joint, that forms part of the foot, and then another one that forms the heel. It's all one. It's all one big thing. Says your papa. One sec. No, they are. The isak that mystic posik, because if not, if you were going to say that there's one bone for the heel and then a separate bone above that for the rest of the foot, kavale istivira me'al, then the ankle would already be me'al because it would be above the foot itself, the shoka, and then the shin would be me'al de me'al, and the shin would be possible. The fact that we're saying that the shin from the knee down to the ankle is kosher must mean that the ankle itself is an integral part of the foot. It's all connected together. Rav Ashi says not necessarily. I could obtain a mystic plastic. No, you could actually argue that there is a separation. You could actually argue that the bones are not fully fused together. But it doesn't matter. Called the Bahade Kara, whatever is at the same level of the foot, Kara Dami is considered like the foot itself. The ankle is at the same level of the foot. Therefore, it's still considered part of the foot, even if biologically it actually, even if anatomically it belongs to a different bone.
So therefore,
the ankle itself, the ankle that sticks out by the side of the heel over here is actually the end of the shin bone. But the Papa is thinking to say that's actually fused with the bones of the foot itself. So Rabashi says you don't necessarily have to say that. You can say all of that. It's not. So therefore, so Rabashi is saying everything that's at the level of the foot and below is considered part of the foot. Above that is called Meha. Whereas a papa, I thought to say, you have the foot itself, then you have the ankle, potentially, which is above that, and then there's the shoit, and then the shin would be me'al de me'al, but Rav Ashi says not like that.
So Rav Ashi is going to...
So Rav Ashi is telling us that... No, so Rav Ashi is telling us that there's the shin, that the shin, tibia, or whatever you call it, is actually considered me'al, because it doesn't matter whether the ankle is physically fused with the other bones of the foot or not. Either way, whatever's at the level of the foot is considered part of the foot, as far as halacha is concerned. Okay. Mishnah says, "May yodai olai." Suppose a person says, "I pledge the value of my hand." So how do we figure out the value of the hand? Shomen osa kamu shofa b'yad or below yad. We figure out how much would the person be worth with the hand, and how much. The zomim of my hand. So we figure out, we evaluate how much would he be worth with a hand, how much would he be worth without that hand. Zechomim ben adonim in be'erchin. There you have a chumra in a neder over an erch. Because with erchin, we learned previously that if a person says erch yodi alai, then it's meaningless. Then it's meaningless. There's no such thing as an erch for a hand. Whereas if a person says dnei yodi alai, then he has to pay. That was as far as the weight. You were talking about the dummy of it, the monetary value of it. So the Gemara says, "Hey, she's shining in. Like, how do we evaluate the value of a person with and without a hand?" We make the same kind of evaluation, Rabbah says, as we would for Nezikin. Suppose that one person accidentally chops off somebody else's hand. So we say he has to pay Nezik, and how do we figure out Nezik? And we figure out how much would the person have been worth as a slave before that, and now that he's missing a hand, he's worth, well, in other words, how much would he be worth if you're selling him in the market? Well, whatever, the point is if you're selling him with a hand and without a hand, how much is he worth? How much was he worth before? What do you mean? Right now, he has no hand. So you go around to the dealers and you ask them, how much would he be willing to pay for somebody? Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm going to ask the doctor's question. Why is the doctor that you have worth a lot more than
that's fine. And when he had two hands, he would have been worth, if somebody hypothetically had bought him as a slave, where now he has his medical expertise and he can heal everybody in the Sultan's harem or whatever, so he's going to be worth $1 million, and now with only one hand, therefore, so it's going to depend. Yeah. Amalei Abaya, but Abaya says, me dummy, how do you compare it? Hossam Gavra Zilu. In that case, the person's value has already gone down because his hand has already been chopped off. But after all, we see him in his already degraded state, and therefore that makes, in other words, that now when we figure out his value, inevitably it's going to be colored by the fact that we see him in a mutilated state. At one second, and meaning in other words, you're undervaluing how much he would have been worth. He still is a perfectly healthy person because he has two healthy hands, and we have to figure out how much he's worth. So it's not the same kind of thing. But Abaya said, no. Abaya says, you don't do it like you do with Nezaki. What we do is we evaluate like this. Kama Adam writes a litin, the Evan, Ha'osa, Malacha, the Yoda Achas, La'osa, the Shte Yoda. We figure out how much would a person be worth, or how much would a person be willing to pay for a slave who's going to do work with one hand only versus one that's going to be doing work with two hands. So the question is, what do you mean? Yodei achas ma'inihu. What do you mean? If he's only working with one hand, you mean if the other hand is missing, hainu hachem. That's the same thing as Rava said. Ela yodei muchtet. You know, Rava said that you evaluate him as if his hand was missing. Ela, no. What Abaya means is yodei muchtevet l'rabbi rishon. Suppose that the deal was, when you're buying this Eved, the deal was that the first master who sold him is still retaining the rights. See, they draw up a document where he says, I still retain rights to his one hand. So you are not allowed to have him do any work for you with his left hand. His left hand, let's say, still belongs to me. So therefore, so we figure out, suppose that you had a contract drawn up like that, you wouldn't be willing to pay full price for such an Eved, because now you can't have the Eved do anything that's going to involve his left hand or both hands. So therefore, that's what Abaya says, you figure out on that basis. Okay. So you figure it on that basis. You say, for example, let's say you have a person who, if you're able to buy the work that he can do with both hands, and let's say, for example, he's a doctor, and therefore he's worth $1 million, but if you're only going to have that you're able to have him do work for you with his right hand, and his left hand, even though it's still perfectly healthy, is off limits to you, then you're only going to be willing to pay $500,000. Okay, then that hand is worth $500,000.
What about if he's, let's say, any difference between his right-handedness or left-handedness?
Whatever it is, you would have to figure out what amount of work can you expect to get out of him with that one hand versus with both hands. Yeah. Okay, normally, by the way, when we have a machlokas Abaya and Rava, usually the halacha is like Rava, except in six cases. Here actually, the Rambam passes like Abaya, and one reason is because Abaya pointed out to Rava that the way he's saying it doesn't seem logical and proposes something else, and apparently Rava may have agreed to that. Okay, so we'll continue with that discussion tomorrow.